we explore the VA's Strength at Home program on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. For veterans living with PTSD, this program helps to improve home life and prevent partner violence. Psychologist Casey Taft of the Boston VA Medical Center created the program, telling NPR in 2016.
When one is exposed to war zone trauma and combat trauma, they are going to be more likely to assume the worst in situations and assume that other people are trying to do harm to them. And they will respond to that with, are more likely to respond to that with aggression.
Join in on these feelings, 800-642-1234. James Groovy Cocroft is Assistant Director of UW-Milwaukee's Military and Veterans Resource Center, retired Navy veteran, completed the Strength at Home program last year. Groovy, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Good morning. We also have Andrea Knowlton with us, the Strength at Home program coordinator for the Milwaukee VA Medical Center. Andrea, welcome to you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, I want to start, before we get to this program, to address anger and aggression among members of the military. And I wonder, Andrea, is that subject controversial in armed services? Is it getting the attention and focus it deserves, or do you find that it's downplayed as an issue in military circles?
I think it is starting to become more prevalent. We're bringing more services into the VA and addressing intimate partner violence. I think that veteran-centric factors such as PTSD and military family stress, substance use, traumatic brain injuries, moral distress, they can all play a role, but are not causal in the higher instances of IPV, intimate partner violence.
Groovy, what do you make of that? Do you think that a military intimate partner violence, domestic violence, is somewhat of a taboo subject?
It is, because people tend to not want to be able to have, like, they don't want to show a sign of weakness in a sense, right? So it's kind of like where they don't want to discuss it, but it happens though, you know. And I was able to get into Strength at Home, so it kind of made me realize what I was going through, and it helped me out a lot.
I want to get to what that was when you entered the program. But first, I'm wondering, Andrea, from what I understand, there isn't really an accurate estimate of the prevalence of intimate partner violence in the military, because there's not a really formal survey like there is for sexual assault and harassment. Do you think the military understands the scope of this problem?
So according to the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence, in the general population, 1 in 3 women and 1 in 4 men have experienced some sort of intimate partner violence. The National Center for PTSD has done research, and they state that for the veteran population, the number could be twice as high. So they are working at getting those statistics.
Groovy, could you take us into the moment when you decided to do this program? What was going on with you?
Yeah, back in May 3rd of 2020, I had an incident with my family that kind of put me in a bad situation where I was not at my best. And with that being said, I reached out to Andrea to see if I can get into the program, because I needed to make a change in my life. And the change is not only for myself, but it's for my family. But ultimately, it was for myself, because I couldn't go on living the way that I was living as far as being aggressive. So, that's what happened. Sorry.
No, that's okay. And I appreciate you opening up as much as you are about this. What was it like to go to these sessions? Can you kind of take us into a session that you went in, that you did?
I spoke to Aunt Andrea about it, she was very kind and understood the things that I was going through. So she, talking to her, it made it easy for me to decide to go. And I was scared. I didn't know what to think. I read up on it previously, and I talked to Andrea about it as well. But just opening up and having that vulnerability was kind of scary, and not knowing what the outcomes would be. So it just kind of, to me, it was a no-brainer because I wanted to be able to change my behaviors and my outcomes or my aggression. So with that, I decided to go because I just felt that it can be beneficial for me and my family and other people as well, to show people that you can still be vulnerable and then still get the help that you need.
Has it made a difference in your life?
180 wow. compared to what I used to be. 2 years ago, I was aggressive in a lot of my interactions with people, not only with my family, but other people as well. And so it has made me really sit back and think about not only myself and how I should conduct myself, but also how I should approach people and how they might feel. And so I can actually kind of can show some empathy towards those other folks as well. And it made me just really realize that you know, what I was doing wasn't right.
I'm going to reintroduce you here for a moment, talking with Groovy Cocroft, Assistant Director at UW-Milwaukee's Military and Veterans Resource Center, 20-year Navy veteran, as we talk about coping with anger and irritability as a military veteran. Andrea Knowlton with us, Strength at Home Program Coordinator for the Milwaukee VA Medical Center. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Andrea, as you hear how Groovy approached the Strength at Home program, how do veterans come to you? In what types of situations, and how do they come to enroll?
They come to me in a variety of ways. So they can be referred to me from a provider. They can call me because they heard about the program from the vet center. They could be court ordered. They could just be looking for some help with wanting to learn how to communicate in their relationships.
And then walk us through those 12 weeks. What does it entail?
I just want to back up a second to something that Veteran Cocroft had said is, you know, it's really important for me in creating this program that's recently been developed with the VA is that the Intimate Partner Violence Assistance Program uses a trauma-informed care approach. And so this way we ensure responses are based on the understanding and recognition, the physical, psychological, and emotional effects of trauma, and then as well as encouragement of safety, healing, and empowerment. So we want to have that inviting atmosphere for someone who's coming in, because this is really a hard thing to talk about. And so, yes, there's 12 weeks. It's 2 hours every week. It is you start together, you end together. So it's a closed group, meaning that everyone starts and ends together. And there's usually about 4 or 5, could be up to 7 veterans in the group. And so they are able to build those relationships and really help each other as they go through the group. And we just guide them with the skills that we're providing.
What about family members? What about those partners who are also going through this aggression at home and seeing this in their veteran? How do you reach out to them?
So that's a great question. Part of Strength at Home was developed to also provide education, resources, safety planning to those who've experienced violence. So when someone enters the Strength at Home program, we ask if they're able to sign a release so that we can not disclose any information about their treatment, but simply say that this veteran's enrolled in the program and we'd like to touch base with you and make sure that you're safe. And that you know what resources are in the community. So it's really important to connect to both sides.
We're discussing veterans programs that aim to improve relationships, prevent partner violence under the Strength at Home program umbrella. We have Andrea Knowlton there, Strength at Home program coordinator at the Milwaukee VA Medical Center. And Groovy Cocroft is with us, UW-Milwaukee's Military and Veterans Resource Center, has been through the program. Join in on anger, on preventing partner violence, on PTSD, what you've been through, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're learning about a program to prevent partner violence and give support to veterans who have PTSD. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The intervention is called Strength at Home, and it seeks to help veterans who struggle with conflict in relationships, providing a safe space for veterans to open up about losing control or hurting a loved one. Join in on holding trauma and the effect it has on your relationships. 800-642-1234. We have Groovy Cocroft, who's Assistant Director of UW-Milwaukee's Military and Veterans Resource Center. And Andrea Knowlton with us is Strength at Home Coordinator at the Milwaukee VA. They're with us for about 10 more minutes. Groovy, I want to bring up another tension here, and that is the reporting of a service member who has been violent at home, and that putting their career in jeopardy like that. Is there a fear of reaching out for help? Because this could put a family's military benefits on the line. It could have a major financial impact on the family. And I'm wondering if that is another barrier for reaching out for help.
From what I've seen with people that I work with and some students that I kind of mentor, in a sense, it is a barrier, in a sense that where they don't want anyone in their business, in the, you know, and they don't want to just tell anything, because sometimes those can have some effects on their employment. However, I tell people, please reach out to your supervisors and other folks if something happens, to the point where they can actually help you get the resources to be able to do that, because people are scared to have anything happen to them. But if something happens to you and you don't say anything, then you tend to get into, you know, to me, more trouble, because if a company finds out about something like this here and you kind of embarrass them, in a sense, and embarrass yourself, they tend to look down on that. So if you do go approach someone, they will be able to walk you through the steps to be able to get the proper help and resources that you need.
I wonder for you, Groovy, you know, you mentioned May 3rd, 2020, but were there triggering moments leading up to that? Or was it kind of like a light switch when you realized you needed help?
It was a triggering moment, but over the years, although I was seeking help, I wasn't properly diagnosed, in a sense, right? And so I didn't have the proper medicines or anything like this, or the treatments that I had wasn't geared towards specific issues that I had with PTSD. Because at first I was just given a diagnosis of generalized anxiety. But then once this happened, although it was embarrassing and I was afraid from my family and myself, it was actually a good thing that happened. And I say that because now I was able to get the help that I need to be able to not be aggressive, to be able to be assertive when I talk to my wife or my children, and be able to actually express how I felt and actually understand how they felt. So it's been a life-saving treatment for myself and my family. And my family said that they noticed a difference in me, because I don't get triggered as often. I think through things. And if we do have a discussion about something that can get heated, we take timeouts to actually calm the situation down, to be able to actually have the conversation without it turning into a negative way.
Andrea, what are you hearing here from Groovy as he finds way more tools in the toolbox, if you will, on communicating and handling moments that could be flare-ups?
Yeah, I mean, I chuckle a little when he says about the feelings piece, because anytime in group when we talk to the veterans about, you know, expressing their feelings, you see the looks on people's faces. You know, because we really talk about common reactions to trauma, and oftentimes people don't really know what those are. And one thing is avoidance, right? So it's a common way of managing trauma-related pain. And you want to avoid reminders of events and try to push away those feelings and thoughts, right? So that can lead to emotional numbness. And so it's difficult for relationships because emotions help couple feel close to one another. And so if you can't express that, then that kind of, it contributes to that divide in the relationship.
Why does combat and war zone trauma make veterans more susceptible, more likely to assume that people are trying to harm them, more defensive, more angry?
Well, I think that after someone's experienced an event, the person often has unwanted thoughts of what happened, and they may think that someone is maybe not paying attention. When in fact the person's just distracted with upsetted memories. So all of these different factors can be part of that.
When you're in that group session with other veterans, is there some power knowing that other people are walking this path as well, that you're in a group where people around you are opening up about something that is really hitting home for you as well?
Yeah, that's very powerful because a lot of times we think that we're alone and that no one understands us and somebody is here. So once we learn that someone else is having that situation, it kind of brings us together to be able to show support for that person, let them know that they're not alone. And then in turn, we all feel, and this is what I noticed in the group that I was in, because it's a group of guys, and we was from all over the state as well, never met each other. And we all, in turn, was there to help and support one another and hear their story. And it kind of resonated of some of the things that we were going through as well. So it helps out a whole bunch. And it just made me feel at home. You know?
Do you still maintain some connections with this group?
I do not. Mm-hmm. I wish I could reach out to a couple guys because we chuckled in class a bunch of times. Like, man, like, too bad you live so far away, because maybe we can hang out or something like that and just go fishing or something like this here. So, it was just great to meet those guys for the 12 weeks that we were in, because it just made me feel at home.
Groovy Cocroft, Assistant Director, UW-Milwaukee's Military and Veterans Resource Center, retired in 2007 after a 20-year military career. Andrea Knowlton is with us, the Intimate Partner Violence Assistance Program Coordinator and Strength at Home Program Coordinator for the Milwaukee VA Medical Center. You can join in with your thoughts. What's coming up for you? 800-642-1234. Andrea, Groovy just brought up something that to me is really interesting, and is that, you know, military families, they move a lot. They live all over. You know, it's one relocation after another. And there, to me, there is isolation in that, in knowing some military families, because it feels like you could just, once you start to set down roots and find resources, you're off to the next base. And I'm wondering if that is a challenge as you work with people through these types of issues.
I haven't found it with technology today. I mean, really, we have been able to, for my program, we've really been able to connect people from all different areas that maybe would not have necessarily gotten the treatment prior, because we can do these virtually. And so people who don't have the ability to travel to their local VA are now able to receive these services. So I actually see it improving.
Groovy, I'm going to be able to give you the last word here. And I know this is a program that really promotes accountability for behavior. What does that look like for your life and the way you are leading it now?
Yeah, like I said before, this was actually a game changer for me as far as learning to actually know who I am. Because I know you made a couple of points earlier in the broadcast about some of the anger issues and stuff like this here that we have. A lot of times in the military, when you're a combat veteran or just in the military in general, we learn to kind of use, not everyone, but a lot of us use our anger as a way to actually do our job, in a sense, because you have to have that fight or flight response. And then once you get done doing all these different things, it's kind of hard to shut that off because you're just training it for years, you know. And so I just want to tell people to be able to please reach out to someone to be able to get this type of help, because it helps you actually tap into things that has been suppressed for so many years as far as like your feelings. And, you know, so I just want people to know that please reach out to Andrea and get this help, because it
help is out there. Yes.
It's a game changer for me. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you both for joining us. James Groovy Cocroft, Assistant Director of UW-Milwaukee's Military and Veterans Resource Center, completed Strength at Home program last year. Andrea Knowlton, Strength at Home program coordinator. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. Here with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about finding connection with nature.
Sometimes an experience touches us in ways. Long Memorial Day weekend, writer Ron Weber witnessed a doe mourning the loss of her fawn, causing him to reflect on the similarities and connections between humans and nature.
Though sunny weather was forecast, my Memorial Day weekend plans did not include picnics or fishing. Yard chores and planting the garden was my fate. Pulling in the driveway Friday after work, I saw my neighbor had cut his first crop of hay. That aroma reminded me of the plethora of sights and smells that make this month of rebirth such a joy, and how much even we humans live with the rhythm of the seasons. Just after supper, as I walked towards the garden, I saw a deer in the field. With deer so plentiful, I never gave it a second look. Finishing my task an hour later, I saw the deer had not moved. Then I knew. Rising just after dawn, the deer was my first thought. I went to an upstairs window, hoping for an empty field. That hope was dashed when I saw a deer walking close to where I had seen it the evening before. I watched the doe walk through the field searching, until I couldn't watch anymore, so I distracted myself with breakfast. Working around the yard, I paused often to look in the field. Each time, there she was. Though often in the area I had first seen her, she also walked the perimeter and through the field, searching, and I surmised, hoping. I was still hoping, too, when about 1 p.m., an eagle circled twice and glided to a landing 10 yards from the doe. It took a couple short hops and began feeding. The doe looked on as the eagle feasted. There was no denying my own sadness now. The eagle fed for a bit and took wing. The doe approached with her head low, and there she stood. As dark crept over the field, she was standing near where the eagle had fed. Call it instinct, dedication, love, whatever it was something to behold. A restless night of sleep followed. In the morning, I rose and headed for the window. I saw a large animal I thought at first glance was a wolf. Instead, it was a big coyote enjoying the spoils. The doe was standing 30 yards away. She sidled in until finally the coyote would have no more. It feigned a charge which sent the doe running. It returned to feed for another 5 minutes before racing towards the woods. The doe made her way back, and there she stood. That evening, I helped my wife prepare a new flower bed. Carrying weeds and sticks to the corner of our yard, through a gap in two spruce trees, I saw a deer 20 yards away in the field. Our eyes locked. I still recall what I saw in those eyes. It was sadness. Was it just the doe's, or a reflection of mine as well? I'm not sure. I tossed my load under the spruce. The doe never moved. I dropped my eyes, turned, walked away, and never looked back. Darkness mercifully came. That evening, I realized I knew better what Alden Leopold meant when he wrote, "For one species to mourn the death of another is a new thing under the sun." I dozed off and slept like a rock. The next morning, the doe was gone. At noon, the farmer baled the hay. The curtain had fallen on this play,
The stage was cleared and the actors left. In my memory, I would save the ticket stub from my weekend with the Doe, in which I learned more not only about the nature of animals, but human nature as well.
Ron Weber is a writer and forester who lives in Weyerhaeuser. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Now to Pfizer. No, not the arena home to our beloved Milwaukee Bucks, but to Pfizer, the Brookfield-based global technology firm, roughly 44,000 employees across the world, in 2021 processed 78 billion merchant transactions. That is some scene-setting courtesy of Pfizer's annual report. So join in on FinTech, on moving money in a digital world, 800-642-1234. Byron Valier is Pfizer's Chief Growth Officer. Byron, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate. It's a pleasure to be here this morning.
Well, good morning. As I said, we know Pfizer of the arena, not so much Pfizer of the corporation, Pfizer of the you. So can you describe the industry and the daily work of Pfizer?
Yeah, I mean, the best way to sum it up is really by our aspiration, right, which is to move money and information in a way that moves the world. Our footprint touches, you know, probably 100% of U.S. households, about 40% of all the card swipes in the United States we process, and whether that's online or at your local 7-Eleven, we are the infrastructure provider behind that. If you pay a bill electronically, we process about 70% of the ACH transactions in the U.S., around $50 trillion. As you said, lots of payments processing goes on, but we're also a big digital provider. So for about 40% of the banks in the United States, we provide all their underlying technology, teller systems, accounting systems. But importantly for, you know, a lot of the folks that are listening to this call, a lot of that digital capability, we build that and provide that to financial institutions, both banks and credit unions. We're the number one. This is a fact that always surprises people. We are the number one publisher of apps into the Apple App Store and into the Google Android App Store. So it's a super interesting kind of technology company really focused on financial services.
I'm thinking like super yikes security oriented. I mean, in all of these platforms you're describing, as people swipe across the world, you're in the back end of this and trying to ensure that all of these transactions go down securely. What is that like to do that type of business?
Yeah, we spend a incredible amount of money on security, on cybersecurity, on resiliency, making sure that all of these systems kind of run in the background like electricity and nobody has to worry about them. You know, bad guys are constantly pinging on the doors of our systems. We have an incredible security team that we have fielded around the world that's focused on making sure that we protect, you know, the front, the middle, and the back. And it runs everything from physical security at data centers to cybersecurity on and encryption on digital platforms. But it is something that is top of mind for us, top of mind for our clients, top of mind for our regulators.
Here's something that comes to mind as you say that, and you're involved in heavily in these payment operations around the world. What about pulling out of Russia? What about the U.S. sanctions and cutting off Russia's accounts and their transactions? Has that been something your company has had a hand in?
Yeah, around the edges, we didn't have a business in the Ukraine or in Russia.
Okay.
But around the edges, we do have processing businesses in Poland, which are actually performing quite well. And, there's a lot of challenges going on there domestically. And we've been more kind of evolved from a tertiary perspective that, Russian credit cards, for instance, processed through China or some other intermediary. Mm-hmm. And there have been mandates from Visa and MasterCard around, you know, making sure that we are shutting off certain financial institutions. And so, we're not directly involved in those markets, but from a secondary perspective, are making sure that we're upholding the sanctions and helping our clients, importantly, uphold the sanctions, both from the federal government as well as, mandates from the big card brands, MasterCard, Visa, American Express.
You mentioned China. How have the COVID lockdowns in China affected the fintech industry? Because China is a huge hub for financial technology services. And just frankly, the size of China and the movement of money, what do you see there?
Yeah, I mean, they have they have a digital yuan, which is a central bank digital currency, and they've kind of been pushing on that, promoted that during the Olympics. I think continues to move forward, and they have a large e-commerce present that's going on there. A lot of that domestic financial services tech stuff doesn't impact the rest of the world. The biggest impact that we've seen within Fiserv and with our clients has been around supply chain, and it's mostly around chips. We have a product called Clover, which is a point-of-sale device. You'll see them at Fiserv Arena when you go up to pay, or you'll see people walk around with handhelds that says Clover on it. That hardware has chips in it, and we've seen supply challenges with chips just like everybody else. We're doing a lot around making sure we're finding alternate sourcing for chips. We're doing it, interestingly enough, we refurbish a lot of that equipment as well, which is good for the environment and drives reuse of components. But I think for a lot of people, this idea of reuse and making sure that you're getting everything you can out of the current kit that you have in circulation is really important.
Oh,
supply chain's been the biggest impact.
You can actually refurbish chips. You can fine-tune them, make them to work with your new systems, and not always have to use new chips or new materials.
Yeah, we typically don't pull the chips out, but we'll refurbish the equipment. And it's
okay.
A little bit like some of the programs around refurbishing iPhones. And
okay.
So, there's an entire industry around consumer electronics, refurbishing them, redeploying them. Sometimes in market, sometimes they'll get sent off to another market to be used. But there's a large industry around refurbishing consumer electronics, and I think it's because of the chip challenges, it's put even more kind of focus on that and making sure that you take advantage of all of the things that aren't being used.
So digital payments, they've soared during the pandemic. Visa saying last year that tap to pay transactions grew more than 30% year over year. How has that impacted your priorities and workloads and what you see going on there?
Yeah, we're very long on tap to pay and on digital payments. We've seen growth in both Google Pay and Apple Pay. We have more and more clients that are investing in digital payments capabilities.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll give you a good example. We have a platform that we released. If you were using your bank mobile banking application, or you're going to a bank and you're going to go open a new account, that account opening process more and more has become 100% digital.
Mm.
And you can take a picture of your driver's license with your phone. You then the app takes a picture of your face, and you have to blink to make sure it's not a photograph. But all of that kind of background checking, once you open that account, typically you would then wait a week and you would get a debit card in the mail. Well, today we can just automatically provision that debit card. You can get all the numbers and the security code off the back of it. We can push it into your Apple wallet or your Android wallet, and you can start using it right away. So in the span of a few minutes, you can open an account, authenticate yourself, deposit money into the account, and then get a virtual card that you could walk down to your local grocery store and go pay with it.
You mean the TV ad?
That wasn't possible.
Yeah, I've seen a TV ad over this. The guy's at the counter, doesn't have the money, and then you see just a little bit of finagling on the phone, and boom, the wallet works.
That's right. And there's just more and more P2P options. We provide a lot of the infrastructure underneath Zelle.
Okay.
And so if you want to go split a bill, you want to send half your rent to your roommate, all of that is getting easier and easier. And banking in many ways, much at a typical bank or credit union, most of the consumer and even the SMB, the small mid-sized business, contact with the financial institution is digital. It's in the mobile app, it's in their online banking, it's at an ATM, right? Like the number of times you actually physically need to walk into a bank has just gone down dramatically. They're becoming, banks and financial institutions are becoming much more technology companies than they were, a couple of decades ago.
Wow. Byron Valier with us, Chief Growth Officer at Brookfield-based global technology firm Fiserv. Join in on FinTech in Wisconsin, merchant payments, the way our world is moving money, what you want to know about it. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Byron Valier here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation about Wisconsin's business climate through the lens of Brookfield-based Fiserv, a global provider of payments and financial services tech. Join in on merchant commerce, on what it means to move money around the globe, 800-642-1234. Byron Valier is Fiserv's Chief Growth Officer with us for about 7 more minutes. Let's bring in a caller now. Jim is joining us from Madison. Jim, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Yeah, I was traveling in Houston, and I heard a discussion on how fast you can make a account to have a card and credit card. So when I checked in, I gave them my driver's license, and they looked at it, but it almost looked like they scanned it while they're sitting at the desk. So I guess, is there ability for a lot of online fraud for my information now to be online or somebody creating an account from that quick trip?
Jim, thank you. Byron, what do you see there?
Yeah, it's a great question, right? And as as we've started putting chips in cards, so those little EMV chips that you see on cards has reduced fraud around cards because you don't necessarily you can't just make a new card and stick it in a card reader. So it has pushed more fraud to be virtual, online. It's called card not present fraud. Jim, what I would say is there is the fraudsters are aggressive. I would say the folks that are battling it are even more aggressive. And so there are things that are going on. Like if you look at doing a payment with your phone. There's actually, your phone gives off hundreds of little data points. The GPS tells you where you are. And so, the fraud systems in the background are saying, well, is Jim at a place that he is normally at? When you enter passwords, it can tell how fast you enter passwords, those types of things. So between geolocation and a lot of behavioralistic data, do you typically do those types of things? Most fraud gets caught. And so, fraud is in general still at relatively low levels. Our financial systems are quite safe. It doesn't mean it doesn't happen. It does happen sometimes. But there's a huge amount of energy being put into it to make sure that payments are safe and sound. And I'd say generally are keeping up with the fraudsters, actually are ahead of the fraudsters in many, many ways.
What about the rise of AI and machine learning and automation? Has that enabled you to bring more security with chips and transactions?
Well, that's exactly what's helping. So
Okay. When
you think about these giant data sets, right? So on a typical day, we'll process 12,000 transactions a second. So it's enormous amounts of volume are running through these systems. And AI, machine learning, allows us to kind of understand what the patterns in those payments are and how people typically spend money, move money around. Financial institutions, banks, and credit unions are doing the same thing, right? They're spending a lot of kind of time and energy kind of understanding what's normal and what's not normal, and all the things that are kind of out of the normal balance get flags on them. You've probably experienced, Kate, you'll spend money somewhere and you'll get a text
yep.
From your card company, it will say, hey, did you spend this money? That's, it's called out of band. But that's them in the background saying, I wonder if this is really Kate or if this is somebody else. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, it's become a much more interactive experience versus, you know, 5 years ago, you might have gotten a letter that arrived 30 days later saying this is an unusual transaction. Now it just happens instantly. Mm. And all of that is making it harder and harder for fraudulent transactions to get through the system.
Jim, thank you for the question. Pete now in Eau Claire. Pete, hi, go ahead.
Hey, I'm a truck driver. I'm 64 years old. And when I was young, everything was transacted with actual cash. When I started driving truck late 70s, there was a thing called a comm check where we'd go to a truck stop and we could get a cash advance on our paycheck. So now we've got all these electronic transactions that are happening, like he just said, 12% of the world. How much money that doesn't exist is floating out there in cyberspace? Because obviously 12,000 transactions a second, that, you know, you're not actually transacting cash. So how much money that doesn't, you know, physically exist in cyberspace?
Yeah, getting our arms around that digital money that's really just floating out there. What can you say about that, Byron?
Yes, it's a really interesting question, Pete. So I would say all that money, you know, really does exist in one way, shape, or form. And so if you're using a debit card, you know, the debit system understands how much, what your deposits look like. The debit network understands what your deposits are at your financial institution, your bank. And so we process that transaction. We know it's $100 and you're buying gas for $100. We know there's $100 in the account, so we approve the transaction. And then actually a hold gets put on it, and it eventually settles through the system. A similar thing happens with credit cards. Now, it's not that there's, you know, dollars sitting in your bank account with a credit card, but you have an approved level of credit at your, whoever the issuer of your card is. And so when that transaction comes through, they check against it and say, do you have, you know, credit on that credit card? Yes, you do. We approve it. That eventually then gets settled. So your credit card balance goes up, and eventually you pay that bill and it comes out of your bank account and goes there. And so the system, these networks are all built to make sure they understand kind of who's using the cards and what level are they authorized to. And then, as I mentioned earlier to Kate, you know, you may have money in your account or money on your credit card. A big transaction comes through. You buy a refrigerator at Home Depot. They'll layer another level of, so you have the money in your bank account or you have the credit. They'll layer another level of security on that and fraud checking just to make sure. And you might get a text that's saying, hey, should we approve this, you know, $2,000 purchase or not? But the systems and the networks understand, you know, what's available for payment across both debit and bank accounts at all times. And
it settles
the following day. But there are, you know, billions and billions of dollars of transactions that are kind of in flight and maybe settling overnight at any one time. And, you know, these systems are built to manage all of this.
Byron, thank you for joining us.
I enjoyed it very much, Kate. Have a great day.
You too, Byron Valier, Chief Growth Officer for Fiserv. I'm Kate Archer-Kent on the Ideas Network.